PodSave America is brought to you by Simply Safe. Summer travel season is officially here. Don't put a damper on your vacation wondering whether or not you remembered to lock up the house. Let a Simply Safe system put your mind at ease so you can get back to the good stuff. You know, John Lovett set up a Simply Safe, and we haven't been able to shut up about it for the last 10 years.
That's true.
But it was easy to set up, and you can arm it right from your phone, and it's provided him great security all these years. With Simply Safe, you can customize your system to fit your needs, then ships fast directly to your door. The app-guided setup is simple and there's no drilling required, so you can install and arm your system in under an hour. Simply Safe is more than just a security camera. It's a comprehensive system of sensors, indoor and outdoor cameras, and 24/7 professional monitoring, so you can feel safe and secure this summer and beyond. Over 5 million people value and trust Simply Safe with their home security every day. Right now, our listeners will get 50% off a new system when you sign up for professional monitoring, and your first month is free. Just visit simplysafe.com/crooked. That's half off at simplysafe.com/crooked. There's no safe like Simply Safe. Welcome to PodSave America. I'm Jon Favreau.
I'm Dan Pfeiffer.
I'm John Lovett.
Tommy Vitor.
We are coming to you from the Obama Presidential Center in Chicago. I think this is the first ever podcast recorded from the Obama Presidential Center. I just made that up.
Yeah.
Or but I think it's a reading library.
I mean, it opened today, so.
That's what I'm saying. It opened today. So I think that we.
Yeah.
How are you?
That's my
nice.
Impression.
Really good. And it's really good.
Thank you.
This is the presidential reading room. In the branch of the Chicago Public Library.
I don't see our book.
Yeah, what the?
You should probably
maybe donate one. Maybe the children's section.
Do we see Dan's books anywhere?
I don't see Dan's book.
I've heard rumors that our books are in here, but I can't.
I see Life of Pi. Anyway, we'll come back to this.
I see What It Takes. Oh, I see my book right there.
Oh, we saw Dan's books.
Two over from What It Takes.
Now, if you're just listening on the audio, I know this is riveting. Yes. Us looking around at the books.
Hey, let's stop navel gazing about the books. Start navel gazing about the event.
So we just came from the event and we just toured the museum for the first time. Are we calling it a museum? The center.
Mm-hmm. Library.
I think it's the Obama Presidential Center is the official name. Mm-hmm. And we just took a little tour. What'd you guys think? Not of the event, of what we just saw on all the floors, Dan.
Obviously very emotional. For us to walk through it and see from the beginning of the campaign through the White House, the good moments, the bad moments. But it's very, very powerful.
Yeah. Love it. How did you feel about what you tried so hard to stop from happening?
Yeah. I mean, look, I think.
So poorly tried.
Well, yeah. I think that the beginning of the museum about the ways in which I couldn't prevent this from happening. And as you move up through the floors, I become more and more excited to be a part of it.
Every time we went by an exhibit and wanted to like take a picture there, Lovett would say like, no, this is stolen valor. I can't do
that. Yeah, it's before, as you get into the administration, then I feel like I can celebrate. Yes. But when it's, you know, the signed, sealed, delivered speech in New Hampshire, I feel like, well, I was kind of on the other side of that. But
it was weird when you just started yelling about caucus rules. That was strange.
Yeah, yeah, superdelegates like, they're legitimate, the superdelegates. It's part of the process. Respect the process. But it's strange to see something set up. It's great to experience it for us, but it isn't really set up for us. No. It's set up to kind of take people through something they might not know about. And it is set up for a longer timeline. It's set up for people to experience over a very long time. And it is interesting to see things you experience written in just such a declarative past tense, like this is what happened. Mm-hmm. This was the history of this moment.
Right, it's history now.
It's history. No, and
we're so old. <It sucks. laughs> Our jobs are in a museum.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, Tommy, what'd you think?
I mean, the museum's amazing. Everyone should come check it out. I mean, Michelle Obama talked about how they wanted it to be interactive. So there's lots of exhibits and speeches and stories of individual people, but you can shoot hoops and we're literally in a library where you can take out a book or you can hang out do a picnic. I think the thing that's been amazing for me and emotional is just all the people we've gotten to just run into. It's like when I go back to DC, you run into a lot of people and a lot of the time you don't want to run into them. Here I've run into a lot of people and every time it's like, I'm so excited to see this person. It's a blast from the past. Like Hannah and I were dealing with a snafu on our bracelets to get in and we ended up in a 10-minute line behind Admiral McRaven. And I was like, oh, Hannah, this is the guy who did the bin Laden operation. Like, that's a conversation you don't have every day.
His bracelet was also incorrect.
It was. He was not allowed into the event, unfortunately. Yes, our friend Joshua Dubois, who's like we've known forever, who used to play pranks in the office and one time changed it. So my Outlook, every time I wrote the word the, it auto-corrected to bag of assholes. He gave the prayer and invocation.
I just want to say that when Tommy realized this, he didn't think it was a prank. And Tommy's just typing emails. And he's like, we're in the Senate office at the time. It's 2006. And he's like, every time I write an email, all of a sudden it just says bag of assholes. It's like, I'm sure that
I was like, I'm almost positive I didn't write bag of assholes in this almost email.
How are you not more sure? It's like when that reporter thought that she was hacked because she had spilled water on her space bar.
Yes.
It was the first story I thought of. And I'm like, and now he's the pastor at this event.
Josh walked up to me last night and said, what's up, you bag of assholes? Anyway, Eddie Vedder was here. He did a musical number with some 13 and 14-year-old kids. They composed it. They put it together. They played it in front of four presidents of the United States. Like, the whole thing has just been it's very cool and inspiring and a home game for us, obviously.
The other thing about the museum, just that I think is really noteworthy, is it is about like how people can learn from what Obama did, what people on Obama did, and do similar things going forward. Like the whole idea is to inspire people to take their community, their country, their lives in their own hands and try to bring change. Like the entire thing from top to bottom at every place of this is about like the core principle.
Agency. Yeah. He's a very young ex-president, as he mentioned today. Not that young, but young enough. And also started as a community organizer here in Chicago. And so I do think that like they were very, you know, the intention of the whole museum or in the whole center from the beginning was that it wasn't just like somewhere we could walk around and see exhibits or just like a traditional presidential library, but that it would be a place, be a community center where like people can go be inspired to, you know, run for office or help their community. Or and so I really think they achieved that. I love the museum. I mean, I went, I first came Tuesday with Emily and the kids, brought Charlie and Teddy, and they lasted a couple hours before Teddy had a meltdown when he tried to eat the fake apple in the fake Oval Office. Mm-hmm.
Didn't go well.
Couldn't eat it. Wanted a real apple.
Yeah.
Cried a lot. We left.
Been there.
Mm-hmm. But before that, I do think that the campaign, there's a whole level dedicated to the campaign, and it tells the whole story of the campaign from beginning to end. And the last panel after you watch the video is Grant Park. And the way they tell the Grant Park story is through newscasts from all over the world announcing that he won. And it just like interviews people in like Africa and people in Europe and people in like Selma here and just talking about what it meant to them. And I was just watching that and I'm like, oh yeah, see, this is a great country. Like, yeah, and we can like, this is, we complain about it a lot and there's a lot of bad things going on right now, but I'm like, this is a great country.
The, you know, we'll talk about the speeches more, but, I was just thinking about nostalgia walking through the museum, and there's a poll that came out the other day that said, which of the previous presidents do you think did the best job? And Obama is the leading president of people who have a positive view of him in hindsight. And you walk around this museum and it has this hopeful view of the country about, you know, the relationship between organizing a community and democracy, civic responsibility, empathy, and, you know, the old fashioned civic virtues. And I did find myself thinking, walking around, okay, this was and is persuasive to people. And I'm leaving thinking, okay, but let's be honest, this museum is opening at a time in which like Trump, it's part of the speeches, it is part of this event that people are aware of what's happening in the country. And like, what are the ways in which this was not made durable after, right? What are the ways in which either this vision of the country wasn't as persuasive as we hoped it would be, or we did not uphold it and use it to make the best case possible to prevent Trump from winning not once but twice? And that was also on my mind because I'm not a nostalgic person by nature. And so I was sort of stuck on that and think, I was trying to like challenge myself to think, okay, this obviously is a vision that I respect and appreciate. What are the ways in which it wasn't able to fully bring more people along after Obama was gone?
It's funny, that was what was stuck in my head before coming here. I was thinking about it a lot, and then I spent today listening to President Obama and Michelle and going through the center. I think that the answer is, at least their answer is, that it's not ever going to be durable. Like, that is the whole point of not just America, but like human nature, that like we're always going to have these moments where you know, people's, we talk about better angels, people's worst angels take over, and that's, and progress doesn't happen in a straight line. And so I think their answer is everyone has to just get to work, right? And everyone has to just keep going and keep, and like, and don't give into like cynicism, and don't, you know, and don't give up.
And the first part of the museum doesn't actually start with the Obama stories. It actually starts with the key moments in history. They're like the one we're in right now, where bad things are happening, you know, whether it, or there are real problems in the country that are being changed, where the civil rights movement, the suffrage movement, all of that stuff, the labor movement. And the, I think the answer to that is, it's like at every point, it's not always going to be good. And, but every time it's been bad and we have dealt with it, it is because regular people came together, they started organizing, they started working, they started voting, and they brought change. And that we can, the, I think the true message of that, so we can do that again. And they didn't write, the, like, obviously this museum was not made for the Trump era.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be around for 100, 200 years after that. But I, like, and this is like always core in what Obama talked about. It's in the Selma speech that adorns the building itself, is that we are always going to have moments like these, and we're going to have to come together to get out of them. And so, you know, maybe a few years from now, things will look much more like they did in 2008.
Maybe, and then, they'll look like 2016 again. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think it's yeah, the, it's the idea that, yes, that is that you step back and say, all right, this is the path of progress. Yeah. Two steps forward, yeah, one step back. There are times where you, where people give into their fears and their whatever, their smallness. But part of the work of getting out of it is not just stepping back and saying, we will come together, yeah, and figure it out. It's like, what happened, right? Yeah. Like, how, what were, yeah, the ways in which this vision of America seemed to some people to be either like false or hollow in some way, or, you know, not able to be replicated by the candidates that followed? Yeah.
Two things. One, back to Teddy. Hmm. It's really cool, and a thing people probably didn't know, that you could walk into the Oval Office and there was a bowl of apples on the coffee table between the two couches, and people would just take them and eat them. And actually, the actual bowl that was on Barack Obama's coffee table for 8 years is now in this museum because our friend Farrell just had it at her house.
Yeah.
And now it's here. That's, I think, a fun little anecdote that people don't know. And two, on the speeches, I mean, I literally was just talking to Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, no big deal. Flex, flex.
Watch your feet, guys.
Right. Watch your feet, guys. And as I'm talking to Josh Shapiro, Hannah comes up. She's like, can we go serve some food? It's like, this, come on, come. Anyway, well, he and I were talking about like
that's,
whether
that's Jewish energy to bring that.
He and I were talking about whether, you know, we watched the speech and felt like the reaction to the speech part of the conversation, like, do we think what he was saying is still real? Like that there are, that people really do want decency and to bring people together and a politics that just delivers for them, because it's so easy to see the social media part of politics and the owning each other and the viciousness from Trump and the moments I feel myself falling into being a shittier person online and,
yeah,
just like dunking on people on Twitter. And honestly, my reaction to Barack Obama's speech was, it made me want to be a better person.
Yes.
And it made me want to be more like him and more like civically engaged and to pay more attention to the messages we're hearing out of people like Shapiro and James Tallarico that are asking us to kind of get back to that brand of politics.
I 1,000% believe that the winning 2028 candidate will be someone who offers a version of that message.
Yeah,
that,
I hope so.
To turn the page on this era of division, of terribleness, for something better. It's not, it won't be exactly the same as Obama's message. The world has changed. People, you know, everyone's, you know, we have a lot of calluses and scar tissue over the last decade, but something that is more like that than the liberal inverse of Trump.
It's funny. I think just the nature of the trip, and we've been doing a whole bunch of things the last couple of days, that I haven't really been on my phone as much. And then where we were sitting, Dan and I were like really trying to get service and then trying to like figure out how to get on the Wi-Fi, and it just wasn't happening. And so like I have seen no takes of any of the speeches, no. Didn't know nothing what was happening. And it really, like, I sat there like, good, I don't want to know what all the takes are out there of what this event is, and like letting all the cynicism creep back in, because I felt like you. I'm like, it does make me want to be a better person. And Michelle, and we'll talk about her speech in a second, but she had this riff in the speech where she talks about how hope is a choice. And, you know, it can just sound hokey when you just hear it like that. But I think what she meant is like, yes, you can decide that things are going to be bad, or that, you know, it's not worth trying, or that, or you can decide like, yeah, things could still be bad, but I'm actually just going to stop complaining and try and like put my shoulder to the wheel and see if I can make a difference.
Yeah. I do think that part of like, you know, what is Trump's skill as a politician? And he can really make people's worst qualities just truer about them. He just has the ability to make something bad. We have good parts and bad parts in us. I mean, the other day I was like, you can, We go do a tour show in Detroit and we say, is anyone here from Michigan? And someone raises their hand and says they're safe, they're from Ohio. The whole crowd like boos them like fucking crazy. There's an ICE agent in every heart. There's this, what I liked about that part of the Michelle speech specifically is choosing Trump takes your agency, and we do not have to ignore people's culpability, the harm of that choice, the fact that they could have made a different one, right? Like hold people responsible and treat them like adults. And I think one thing that Barack Obama does as a politician is he tries to treat people like adults, and a politics that treats people like adults.
The other thing he does that I think we as a party are sometimes missing is he is unabashedly patriotic.
Yes.
And talks about his love for the country. And that doesn't mean he hides the imperfections of the country. He is a living embodiment of the worst stains in our history, but he is patriotic and he talks about the love of the country. And I think people want that, and they want to be a part of a movement that is patriotic. And I was reminded of this when we went to I went to the USA Paraguay soccer game the other day, and like just being with thousands of people chanting USA, USA, and like loving their country and cheering for the players. And like the fact that a bunch of them are immigrants, right? And one was like literally like his mother, like the Ben Shapiro is out there calling him an anchor baby, right? And this guy scored 2 goals. Like it just, getting back to that brand of politics is so important.
I talked to Jerusalem Demsis about this for Offline this week. And she was saying I haven't seen it, but there's this whole discourse online around the World Cup where all of these people are coming to America and then they're like posting, America's really great and people are so nice.
They're going to Waffle House.
Because everything that they hear about Trump, they thought coming here would be this like dark dystopian. And they're like, this is a wonderful country. And I thought about that walking through the center too. And I was like, this has been my feeling the last 2 days here. Yeah. I'm like, this is a fucking great country. Like it is a great country. Yeah. And just because Trump is president and we don't like what's happening, it doesn't mean that we should say, oh, this country sucks now. It doesn't.
Don't let them take this from you.
I think like holding just the like, this is not who we are. Well, you know, Trump is who we are, but also what this Obama's represents who we are too. The part where in the speech where he started, he talked about the 250th anniversary, and it just was a small moment for me of just like, there's so much noise around Trump politicizing the 250th birthday and the UFC fight on the lawn and the Trump rally on the National Mall and the reflecting pool and all the rest. And that's a terrible price, just that this is what he's doing with this moment. But also the opportunity cost of just like what it would have been like to have literally any other person in that job who just had some modicum of patriotism or respect for the country to understand how to make it a genuinely uniting moment. And the fact that he doesn't even have
could have been a Republican president. Like I wouldn't have been happy about that, but like could have been a Republican president that brought the country together around America's 250th easily.
I have no doubt that George W. Bush's 250th America thing would have annoyed me in certain respects.
For sure. But there would have been really nice moments and we've been okay, I feel good.
It was nice also in
a sense of mission.
Yeah. Yeah. When Obama gave a shout out to, he was like, John McCain loved this country like I did, like Mitt Romney did. Yeah. You know, there was a nice bipartisan spirit to it that wasn't, I thought, corny and cliche.
Positive America is brought to you by Bombas. Summer has arrived, longer days, outdoor adventures, and more reasons to move. As the weather warms up, upgrade your go-to footwear with everyday essentials from Bombas. Bombas are cushioned where you need it, sweat wicking, and they don't slide around, so you're not constantly adjusting your socks. Step into warmer weather with the Bombas Friday Slides, made from ultra lightweight, waterproof EVA material. These sandals deliver incredible comfort without sacrificing support. They're perfect to just slip on and go, whether you're running errands, lounging outdoors, or just want something comfy and casual to wear. I think I've said this before on the show. I threw out a bunch of disgusting old socks with holes that wouldn't stay up and were just terrible. And I bought a bunch of Bombas, and I have not looked back since.
I love Bombas.
You know what the no-shows are great? You know how like the no-show socks, which I know the Gen Zs are not into these days.
Yeah, well, you know what? I am.
You look stupid in your high socks. You know the no-shows, they always fall down. The Bombas have these like three little like kind of rings on the back that keep them up. They never, ever fall down.
They fall down and they're thin enough that they get the holes easily. Mm-hmm. Bombas, not so much.
Not Bombas. And for every item you purchase, an essential clothing item is donated to someone facing housing insecurity. One purchased, one donated, with over 150 million donations and counting. So basically, if you don't buy Bombas, you are stealing clothes out of the arms of people who need them. So
don't do
think about that. Head over to bombas.com/crooked. Use the code crooked for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/crooked. Code crooked at checkout. Pod Save America is brought to you by Acorns. If you want to take control of your finances today and do something about the money you could have tomorrow, Acorns wants to help. Acorns is a smart way to give your money a chance to grow. It couldn't be easier. You can sign up in minutes and start automatically investing your spare money, even if all you've got is spare change. The Acorns Potential Screen lets you find out what your money is capable of. It shows you the power of compounding and how your money could grow over time. Plus, you can quickly adjust how much you're investing every day, week, or month to make sure you're building towards your goals. No more finance apps cluttering up your phone. With Acorns, you can invest, save, and give your money a chance to grow in one trusted place. Acorns is really helpful because sometimes investing can seem like, ew, I don't know where to put my money. I don't have a financial advisor. What do I do? Acorns, you just start with even just a small amount of money. Set it, forget it. It
just happens forever.
Exactly.
You're never gonna time the markets, people. You're never gonna find the bottom. Just start investing now. Keep going. Forget you're even doing it, and you'll be like, whoa.
And hope
I saved a lot of money.
Trump, you know, figures out a deal to end the Iran war.
Yeah. That'd be good.
Sign up now and Acorns will boost your new account with a $5 bonus investment. Join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $27 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/crooked or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 2 compensation provided. Potential subject to various factors such as customers' accounts, age, and investment settings. Does not include Acorns fees. Results do not predict or represent the performance of any Acorns portfolio. Investment results will vary. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/crooked.
Speaking of that, I think we do have a clip from Obama's speech that we can play and then react to.
How are you?
That's it. Tommy
that
did
was it.
Tommy has the clip.
The exhibits in the center are not meant to evoke nostalgia for some gauzy bygone era, some unattainable past that we can dream about and say, oh, we miss you, Barack. They're meant to remind us of who we can be, to remind us of what's possible, so we can forge ahead, clear-eyed and confident, and do the work that still needs to be done.
I wanted to play that clip because I think he had done a few interviews before today where I think he got questions from reporters that were in the vein of, like, isn't this nostalgia or isn't this like a long-lost era and doesn't it feel like a different reality because of what we're dealing with right now? And he actually wanted to respond to that in the speech. And I think in a way it's the mission of the whole center, which we were just talking about. And I think they're very sensitive to the idea that this is either a monument to them or about the accomplishments of the administration or about some gauzy past. And what it is supposed to be is basically like a pep talk for America,
yeah,
which today was, I think, yeah. A badly needed one. But yeah,
I think a lot of people are frustrated that he's not more engaged with kind of like the politics of the day to day. And I think we've even at times expressed like wishing he was just talking about things. But he talked about the Twin Cities and the way they stood up to ICE and came together as a community. I thought that was clearly about this moment.
Yeah.
He talked about government is more than one that divvies up the spoils, that punishes enemies, that keeps those that are different from them in their place.
Like, shot at George W. Bush.
He's like, I do not believe how that's how the story of America ends. Like, we'll talk about Michelle's speech in a minute, which is a little more directed at the Trump administration. But I thought Obama's very much commenting on the politics of Trump today.
I would just say criticizing museum for being too nostalgic is just idiotic.
It's just, fair point.
This museum looks backwards. Which way does your museum face?
I think it was a New York Times piece.
It was a Peter Baker.
Yes. Piece, yeah. And it was like, I get why reporters would write that, right? Because we are living in this reality. Yeah. And then you step in here and you're like, okay, is this just a pining for the past kind of thing?
Sure.
And what they're really trying to say, and this goes to your point about how people complain like Obama's not more involved in politics. And what Obama always says is, like, I don't want to be out there forever because I want the next generation of progressive leaders to be out there and to like have their moment. And
maybe this will be the election cycle that happens.
Right. And I think the point of the center and the point of the foundation.
And Lucy with the football. Right,
yeah. But I think the point of the center and the point of the foundation especially is to train and inspire young leaders here and all over the world. And I think that is, it finally makes sense to me now because like it is nice when Obama goes out there and he's great on the campaign trail and he gives great speeches and he motivates people. And that's important to have in Democratic politics. But we do need leaders who are not Obama and who take the spotlight in the next 10 years, 20 years.
Yeah. Also, I agree with all that. But also, it's okay to be nostalgic. I'm not nostalgia doesn't do it for me in the same way. I'm not really like a hope person. I'm more of an anger and rage person. But I understand its value in the same way that Trump appeals to
people. You're more of an experienced person.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's right. And in small doses. Best in small doses. Yeah. But,
and especially when experience plus strength.
Right. And obviously, as I've said, change equals one divided by, no, wait, what is it? Strength plus experience equals change. So change divided by strength plus experience equals one. But back to the museum. Like, it's okay to be nostalgic, right? Like, yes, this was a moment where people were really hopeful and A lot of good was done. A lot of things weren't finished, but people believed in the mission. They cared about it. They fought to make it happen, and they elected him twice, and it led to really good things. That nostalgia is a good thing to feel, and there's a way in which too, like
especially if it inspires you to act.
Yes, right?
It's good to feel, but it's also good to like be like, oh, well, then I'm going to go do something.
And there's a lot of people who are very, very hyper engaged in politics. It applies to a lot of people that are partisan. It applies to a lot of people that are nonpartisan journalists. That they see that is inherently naive. That there's something inherently naive about having that warm and good feeling about politics in any way. That it's cringe, right?
Like, I think it applies to us sometimes. I've been in those moments all the time.
But I had this moment where I was watching. I think there was a moment where Bono was singing "Michelle, My Bell," and boy, I have a photo. I'm cringing. I got a photo of Tommy just cringe, just a full body cringe. But why do we cringe? And I think it's sometimes because we're uncomfortable with a display of care or like a direction that we might agree with, but take something too far in a way that feels syrupy or saccharine in some way.
And you were wondering, is he hitting on her?
Yeah, that was a word.
Obama did
bar.
Say, leave my wife. Don't touch my wife. Yeah. Yeah.
But it was a lot of, to your point, like in the 2020 election, like, you know, it was a thing you'd hear online that people were like, oh, we're just going to vote our way out of this problem. It's like, well, yeah.
Yeah,
actually, the whole thing. That's democracy.
I mean, it's not the only thing you're going to do, but at some point you do have to vote.
Otherwise,
if you don't do it, a lot of the other stuff you're going to try isn't going to do much.
Right. Right. Well, otherwise it's not a democracy. And then we're the other system that we say that we're against.
Right.
Yeah. So you do have to have a vote at some point. Let's talk about Michelle's speech. Let's just listen to a clip because then we can comment on it.
The Native kid showing us that resilience and pride can never be stolen. The 4-H'ers and FFA members with calluses on their hands from feeding livestock. The immigrants proving what it truly means to be a dreamer. These folks aren't Americans too. They are America. They are the beating heart of this country. They are us and we are them. Deep down in our hearts and souls, we all know right from wrong. We know selflessness from greed, righteousness from injustice. All of us are created equal. That each of us is a child of God with inherent value. And no one, and I mean no one, has the right to sit in judgment of who's American enough.
So I will say, I get like a little misty when I saw the Grant Park panel at the center. But the first time this whole week that I actually just like cried was during her speech.
Oh yeah, for sure. I saw the sign language interpreter wiping tears. Yeah.
I did too. It was very sweet. It was a fantastic speech.
Like, listen,
I mean, it's almost cliche to say it that like Michelle Obama always knocks it out of the park, but it really was this time.
I thought Obama's speech was really good. She, like, I can't remember the last time I didn't see her just kind of knock the cover off the ball. I'm trying to think of a bad Michelle Obama.
The part that also was really moving was she says at the beginning, I'm going to do what Barack won't want me to do and just like brag about him. And And she talks about like how he carried himself in the 8 years as president. And that's what like really did it for
me. Yeah,
too.
I lost it at that point.
It is, I see him crying though.
It is like what she said about him is like what we know, but just like he is such like a decent human, like just truly to his core decent. Like he's flawed, like he's a human, but he's a decent human. I think all the time about like the one thing, and this is like at the core of what Michelle was saying, but I used to think all the time about how every, like, I'd be in meetings with Obama where it'd just be like people who he saw a lot, he'd be pretty grumpy, right? Like shit is bad going on. But then someone would come in the room who'd be like a younger staff briefing on something or someone coming in for a visit. And he like instantly knew that that interaction with him, maybe that's the only time they'll ever meet a president in their life, was going to be matter.
Life-changing
for them. And he would, no matter how shitty the day was, he would pull it together and just like treat that person with the utmost respect and make that like a special moment. And that is like that to me is always like summed up who he is. And it was really just powerful to hear Michelle talk about it that way.
I always thought that there was an irony in the Obama campaign being about change and that carrying him all the way to the nomination. But ultimately, he is able to defeat John McCain because in the weeks of the financial crisis, what actually carried him all the way to the presidency, which was not a quality that I think was necessary for his rise until then, was a kind of preternatural evenness, reliability, consistency, trustworthiness, a calm that was sort of in his bones that infused everything that he did. And it gave people the assurance, unspoken, that they could take a chance on him when John McCain was supposed to be the more senior and seasoned person, but had seemed erratic in the lead up to the election. And when people would say things like which Michelle referenced, that, oh, he wasn't qualified, he wasn't this, he was that. It's like, why is he qualified? Well, look at how he is modeling what it means to be a senator and a candidate in a way that, say, Sarah Palin, right, who could claim a similar whatever experience in the public in elected office that didn't have the same effect. And now we're all these years later, and it just stands in contrast to what Trump is. And the fact that there were so many Republicans who spent 8 years denigrating him as a person, pretending he was some threat or some alien or some evil and socialist sort of extreme force, when of course the whole time he was this even-keeled, center-left, consensus-building, reliable figure, which now in hindsight the country like terribly misses.
Yeah, I think when I just like think about why I was lucky to work for him, like, yeah, he was cool. Yes, he was a great communicator and speaker. But the thing, upon like a long time of reflection, that I've come to realize was the best part about working for him is that on literally anything, you could go to him and he had a core belief about whatever it was. Yeah. And that was from a good place, that was from a sense of decency. And like, yes, politics are part of everything, but it was about doing the right thing. And like, you just never doubted that, or like their motivation of their family. And it's just like, contrast that to like, you walk in the Oval Office now and they're fucking day trading on the war with Iran. Yeah. It's just insane where we've gotten.
One of my favorite lines about Obama ever is that Ta-Nehisi Coates line at the beginning of that long piece about him at the end of the administration, which was for 8 years, he walked on ice and never fell.
Yeah.
And it was about race and how he handled race and being the first black president. But I also think it was about so much more than that, is that like the job of president and the job of him being president and being the first black president, as Michelle also mentioned today, it requires so much care and thoughtfulness and like balance of so many different competing interests and competing desires within yourself and trying to channel your emotions and trying to suppress some emotions. And I feel like Michelle's speech was that line, that Ta-Nehisi Coates line.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it was so affecting, because I was like, you know, I think we all get that having been in politics. Like, we all do that. We've all done that throughout our time in politics, as you realize that so much of the job is constant thinking about like, what is the right balance of this and that? And how do I not piss this person off? And how do I persuade this person? And like, so much care goes into it. And the fact that he was able to do that and get through 8 years still intact is just like, you know, it's inspiring.
I think being the first black president like what Michelle said, that like anyone who worked with him or worked from the very beginning knew the historic nature of his candidacy and the different set of rules that were applied to him than any candidate. And it's the same way different set of rules were applied to women candidates. And
he refused to complain about it.
He refused to complain about it. And he could, and Michelle, like that was subtext of everything that we always talked about. But Michelle made it text,
yeah.
Right? And said very clear that he, for 8 years, could not make a mistake. He could not slip up. He cannot lose his temper. He cannot lash out. He cannot send an angry tweet. He had to bear the expectations and the pressure of being the first black president, because how he did it was going to dictate if and when we had a second black president.
Yeah, right. For example, literally just pointing out that Trayvon Martin looked like what his son would look like if he had a son, right?
She said that today, and I was like,
yeah, she leaned in.
Yeah, and I think that, and I think
she got some stuff off her chest today, which I liked.
Yeah,
but she always does.
Yeah,
but like it was great.
It was
funny.
We should talk about like the backdrop of all of this, invisible in the backdrop, and sometimes not very visible, is Trump.
Yeah,
And how they all kind of how they both handled that today.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's funny. I felt the same way at the convention too, that when Michelle's speeches, there's like an edge and a kind of darkness to them, mm-hmm. that I'm like, oh. I'm always caught off guard by it. I'm like, oh, like she's pissed a little bit. Like she's going to say some things that she's feeling about what's going on right now. And it always works, because I do think like she taps in. It matches what he does. It sort of complements what he does, because she has this, she understands how to use that feeling people have. That's all, we're living through the Trump era. We're always a little bit mad. We're always a little bit upset. It's always there. It is a cloud over our society. And she just, without saying the name, she just said, you know what? That's a part of today. And it makes me upset too, because not just because of what's happening right now, because of what the other standard that was applied to Barack Obama when I saw what kind of a man he was.
The thing that I think will probably like get clicky is like, you know, he actually won a Peace Prize, right? That was the fun shot of Trump. The thing that I thought, to your point, Lovett, about the darkness was failing to see the humanity in others puts us on a slippery slope when she's talking about immigration.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? She's like talking about this slide to fascism in her remarks.
I can't remember who said this, but someone said about Michelle after her convention speech in 2024 that she is your friend who just tells you like it is. Does not beat around the bush, just tells you exactly what you need to hear. And her speeches always just reflect that. Like there's no, like there's a way to make those points that are so subtle that like no maybe you, yeah. you, or you get it, but you've basically wasted a bunch of words. That she just says it always, and it's what makes it so powerful.
I always roll my eyes when people are like, Michelle Obama should run for president, because we obviously know she's never going to run for anything because she despises politics. But again, today, like halfway through the speech,
I know,
as I was crying, and then Emily was also crying next to me, she was like, I mean, maybe she should run for something. Like,
I had the same exact thought.
Like, are we crazy, or was this?
I had the same thought. Then I slapped myself.
I'm like, Tommy. We can want it all we want. She's not going to do it. She can command a stage.
By the way, we're in a working building. There's some, you might hear some background noise.
Positive America is brought to you by Stamps.com. We could all use a few more hours, even minutes in the day for ourselves. Skip your trip to the post office and save some precious time with Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can print postage and shipping labels from your computer or phone 24/7 with up to 90% off UPS, USPS, FedEx, and more. There's no lines, there's no trips, there's no waiting. Get everything done in minutes. Even schedule free pickups so that letter carrier, they come right to you. How about that? Whether you're sending letters, contracts, important legal documents, or packages, Stamps.com makes mailing simple for businesses of all sizes, including multi-location offices. You can even send certified mail with proof of delivery right from your desk. We love Stamps.com. We've been using Stamps.com for a very long time.
Since we founded Crooked. Since
we founded the company, we've been shipping stuff. We've been sending merch, sending important business things. Who doesn't love stamps? It's a way you send stuff. It's how you stamp approval. They got tramp stamps.
Tommy's got tramp stamps.
Briefly said Mike Pence for president. True story. Awkward. Anyway, if mailing is taking more time and more money than it should, try stamps.com for free for 4 weeks and get a welcome kit. Go to stamps.com/PSA to get this offer today. That's stamps.com/PSA. Stamps.com/PSA. Taxes and fees apply.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
we still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's Jon Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that.
Sound,
I'm deeply
doesn't
stupid.
Doesn't sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
One more thing before we move on. Dan, you had a message box today in honor of today.
I did.
About what Democrats can learn from Barack Obama, which I thought would be a nice way to end this section.
Yeah, well, I think, Obama sets every election cycle, he goes out, he goes on the trail, and everyone says, like, why can't more Democrats talk like this? And Obama's obviously, as we all know and everyone is, a generationally talented communicator. And so just telling people to be more like Obama is like not helpful advice. It's like, right. Be more like Michael Jordan.
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
yeah. Dunk more.
Yeah. But I think there are like a few things that any communicator can take from him. And I'll just give you a couple. One is, like, and Tommy, you mentioned this, is that there is this inherent patriotism in everything he says. Like, he owns it. He will not let Republicans take patriotism. He is not, he will, you know, and often does talk about all the flaws of this country, but makes the point about what a special place is. You heard that today. The other one is that he, you know, and I remember this early on in the administration, we were going to do a YouTube town hall, which was like very innovative at the time, which was just a town hall that streamed on the internet. But YouTube was hosting it, and
we're doing a YouTube podcast.
And they were taking questions in YouTube comments. I can't remember, but the number one topic by far was legalization of marijuana. And so we went in to say, like, this is number one question, but you don't, like, we don't have to take it. And he's like, you always have to talk. He's like, well, if it's the number one question, we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, talk about the thing.
Because he will always say, it's like, you always have to talk about the thing, right? The elephant in the room. You cannot avoid it. Just take it head on, you know? And then the last thing I think is really powerful is we talk all the time about, like, how Democrats need a better affordability message, economic message, all of this. And what Obama always understood is that the discussion of the economy is not really about policy. It's not about how many times you say affordability. It's not whether you say bottom up or middle out. It is a story about values, about who you're fighting for and who you're fighting against. And like, that is the frame to bring to all of this. Like, and this is like, ultimately, I think the biggest thing to take from Obama over the whole time is that politics and messaging is a storytelling exercise. It's not a slogan. It's not a soundbite. It's not a tweet. It is an overall narrative about the country, about why you are the person who should be elected, why the other side should not be elected, and fitting things into those stories.
Yeah. What do you have to say about this moment that we're in right now and the country and where you want to take us? What do you have to say about it?
Yeah.
Like, and everything has to flow from there. Message flows from there. Policy flows from there. Like, that's where you have to start. And like, you know, Michelle and Barack Obama had something to say today, right?
Yeah.
And people can have something completely different to say, but you still need to run for president having something to say about this moment that is beyond just Donald Trump and what policies you want to enact when you're president. Okay, let's get to some news before we leave, because I guess news has been happening.
We've not had access to it, but we hear it's happening.
We got the text of the Iran deal, apparently, the MOU. And boy, is it a stinker.
Tommy, was the Treaty of Versailles an MOU?
I don't know. It's a good question.
Yeah, so we have a Treaty of Versailles. He signed it in Versailles with Macron.
Which is an insane choice.
Wait a second.
Didn't they auto-pen it?
I'm sorry. I'm learning this in real time. You're telling me they signed this piece of paper in literal Versailles?
Yes. Dude, he stayed an extra day just to go have dinner in Versailles.
And it's not even,
it's real gold.
And it's not even the signing ceremony. It was just like, he decided to just sign it in Versailles.
That's crazy.
Yeah. And it's like the it's like the 20th crazy thing about the text, which
Versailles.
I guess the administration official read all the text of the MOU.
You couldn't just copy paste.
CNN, Bloomberg got it, and then CNN got it, I think. But then the administration, Stephen Chang, was like, "They're just wrong. That's not the text." And
dude,
like,
I got it from the president of Iran's Twitter.
And the real one ended up being like a couple words were different, but not by any not anything significant. So the Memorandum of Understanding, the MOU, the Treaty of Versailles.
The MOU of Versailles.
We got episode title.
MOU of Versailles, right, yeah. The memo calls for the suspension of the naval blockade of Iran's ports and for Iran to use its best efforts to allow traffic through the Strait of Hormuz without tolls.
Try your best.
For 60 days. It calls for a permanent end to a war in Israel and Lebanon. Iran is allowed to resume exporting oil. We'll get access to a $300 billion redevelopment and reconstruction fund. The MOU creates a 60-day window for negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. And in the meantime, Iran reaffirms its longstanding commitment not to procure or develop nukes. So it's not playing super well.
No.
You got your Bill Cassidy's, John Cornyn's, all the people who feel liberated now that Trump has defeated them. They have been voicing some criticism. Other Republicans are just sort of hiding.
So funny, these guys. He threw you off a mountain, and then while you're rolling down towards your demise over a cliff, I never liked you.
The Iran hawks are very mad. You've probably consumed
a lot of Mark Levin content.
Those Ben Shapiro's tears in there.
I've been watching some Ben clips. I might have downloaded a commentary podcast from John Podhoretz.
Yeah, Tommy's got the Daily Wire open in an incognito window.
Who's in the bathroom? We think we have a clip of Trump talking about the MOU of Versailles in France.
Then it's a memorandum of understanding. If it doesn't get done in 60 days, that's all right. We go back to bombing. Unlike Barack Hussein Obama, who sent Iran pallets of cash and any relief they receive under this deal, they'll have to get based on merit. And it won't be from us. We don't have to give them anything. But some people may want to invest. I said, well, what am I going to do? Am I going to let Saudi Arabia have missiles, but they can't have them? Yes, sir. Missiles aren't the problem. Missiles are, they hurt a little location, but they don't blow up the planet. And in all fairness to Bibi Netanyahu, who happens to be a good man, gets a little excited sometimes. We have a little dispute over Lebanon. I say, you can do a little softer touch, Bibi. You don't have to knock down a building every time somebody walks into it that's from Hezbollah.
Yeah, that's true.
That was that got me. There, I'm sorry. That got, and the other one too is every time
the best case.
The other line was you shoot a couple of missiles down that don't hurt anybody in the desert. You're knocking down a building in Beirut. It was like imagine the shit that we brought down on these people. And I'm sorry. No, I just the idea. The number of times these fucking anti-JCPOA people were like, this doesn't even address ballistic missiles. Ballistic missiles.
This is support for proxies. Rubio said it a million times at the beginning of this.
This is why the deal is so shameful. You're going to give them money, but they're not addressing the core problem of the ballistic missiles and Hezbollah and their proxies. And then Trump gives up completely. And $300 billion is what? Three times, four times as much as what was ever contemplated but also, by the Iran deal.
They got an immediate license to sell oil and gas. So they're going to be making money off of that. Then they're clearly planning to, you know, they call it fees, but they're going to be toll ships in the Strait of Hormuz. Iran's going to make so much money off of this. I mean, look, big picture, the best outcome is the war being over. So like, I'm happy. The original sin here is this war starting. And the best thing that come out of this is that the fucking Lindsey Graham Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, neocon hawk worldview is smothered to death, right? And that Trump hates these people and that he runs them out of DC. But they cleaned his clock in this deal. And then just hearing him just on this ballistic missile thing, clearly like the reason you would go to the core national security priority with Iran is preventing them from getting a nuclear weapon, right? Like non-proliferation is a good thing generally. I think the way you do that is through negotiations, not bombing them. We did, you know, fuck up a lot of their infrastructure, but whatever, they can rebuild that. But to hear Trump from going from these maximalist positions to being like, who cares about the nuclear dust? We got eyes on it. Maybe we'll get it out. Maybe we won't. It's like head spinning. Yeah. And then on the ballistic missiles, like remember when Rubio went up to Capitol Hill and he did that press conference where he blamed Israel and then ran away and didn't talk to the press for 2 months. The core argument they were making there is that Iran was on the cusp of having a ballistic missile arsenal that would make their nuclear weapons program like impregnable and that we couldn't go after.
Oh, right. I forgot about
that. And now Trump is like, eh, who gives a fuck? They can have some ballistic missiles. It's no big deal.
If the Saudi Arabia, I mean, Rubio also was like, this, our goal is to stop them from their ability to project power in the region. Right. Ballistic missiles is how you project power. It is the definition of their power in the region.
Having read the MOU this morning, the text, I was like, did we get anything from this?
No.
The theoretical
opening of the strait for 60 days.
The theoretical opening of the strait that Iran and Oman are going to jointly control and can charge fees whenever they want. And before the war, the strait used to be open and controlled by no one because it was international waters, right? And there were no tolls. So, I don't think we got anything.
And the theory of the case on the nuclear negotiations is that your leverage is military action and sanctions. And he just gave up both of those in advance of the 60 days of talks over the nuclear program.
And he says, we can just go back to bombing them. But
no, you won't.
Iran knows that as we get closer to the midterms, he's not going to go back to bombing them.
Go back to bombing them. They're not going to get bombed out of, their nuclear know-how.
We just unleashed a bombing campaign for weeks. It cost us tens of billions of dollars. And the end result is an unconditional surrender in Versailles. So I don't know what additional bombs are going to do for anybody. The other thing is, I don't know if you're going to go to it, but you had Vance sort of brushing back the Iran hawks and specifically referring to pro-Israel Iran hawks saying Trump is the only leader on earth that is sympathetic to Israel's point of view and we're the leader of the world's superpower, which for Vance, I'm glad Vance said that, right? It's like, look at what, for all these people that claim to be so pro-Israel, right? That have turned AIPAC into this partisan weapon, that have alienated Democrats, that have turned Israel into pariah state. Do you feel good about where Israel's at now? Alone in the world, beholden on Donald Trump, a guy that does not give a fuck what happens, who could turn on a dime. Do you think this was a long-term great play? Now the Democratic Party opposed to the Netanyahu government. Israel has never been more unpopular in its entire history. It's never been more isolated. You guys feel good about where you landed after all this while calling everybody out there anti-Semites and anti-Israel? You think the people that might have been saying that Benjamin Netanyahu was terrible for Israel might have had a fucking point rather than calling us all self-hating Jews? Anyway, that's just a little point I wanted to make about that.
Well, it just went very quickly. I want Democrats to just stand up and support the JCPOA and say that it was better. Stop all the fucking throat clearing about its flaws and what was omitted. The JCPOA is better than what Trump may eventually get here, because with the JCPOA, Iran shipped out 97% of its stockpile. It was out of the country and went to Russia. In this case, we're talking about downblending it to making it less usable for nuclear weapons. In the JCPOA, that went through the UN Security Council. Right. So this was, they had sanctions and the backing of all their closest allies, like the P5+1, et cetera. This will have none of that. And now this $300 billion slush fund, what are we doing here? All these Gulf countries are now getting told they're on the hook to rebuild Iran when Iran was firing ballistic missiles at them.
Can we talk about, before we move on to this, you mentioned J.D. Vance. I want to sort of ask a hacky political question, which is, I read in Playbook this morning, I think, that a lot of J.D. Vance's opponents or detractors are trying to hang this deal around his neck and saying it's J.D. Vance's deal. And there's people from J.D. Vance's office that basically pushed back and said, those people obviously can't read a poll because this war was very unpopular. And the idea that this is going to be bad for J.D. Vance to be associated with this deal, this treaty, is crazy because people don't want war anyway. And so it's not going to be a real political risk for him at all. What do you guys make of that? Because I think it brings up the question of how this war and how it ended sort of plays out politically, or whether it even does, whether it has a lasting political impact as we head towards the midterms and beyond that.
I think on a substantive political level, no one is going to remember the war by the time that voting happens in
November.
Not in this November. I think the question is about J.D. Vance's presidential race. Yeah. So by the time we get to, I think the war will matter this November in a couple of ways we can talk about. When it comes to the Republican primary or the general election of 2020, J.D. Vance and nominee, I think anyone's going to remember it. I think the damage of the war to J.D. Vance is, I think it has ensured that Donald Trump will be a very unpopular president. When J.D. Vance is possibly trying to be the third term of that very unpopular president. I think that is bad for him.
The
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Not everyone experiences summer as an endless parade of hot dogs, vacations, and pool parties. For some people, life's woes don't abate when the temperature climbs and the days get longer. If you've got summertime blues or are simply feeling overwhelmed, BetterHelp is there when you need it. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works with an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. BetterHelp does the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recs. Love therapy. It's great. You need it. I need it. Everybody needs it. You don't have to say yes to everything this summer. Find support in therapy. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/PSA. That's betterhelp.com/PSA.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply stupid.
Doesn't sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Speaking of ants, he's been on a book tour about his conversion to Catholicism.
Tough timing, man.
Yeah. Tough timing. Yeah, it's really, this ruined the tour. He went to The View, went into the Lion's Den on The
they
View.
They did a great job.
I haven't watched any of
the questions are really good.
This, you're learning for the first time.
Yeah,
now.
This clip will be my first my first experience with JD on The View. So let's take a look.
Everybody knows that Americans are struggling. What is he spending all this money for?
Well, I got to defend the president on the hoax point. What the president said is the idea that Republicans caused the affordability problem is a hoax.
He just said he loves the inflation.
What he said, Anna, what he said is that he loves the fact that the inflation is going to come down when this war is over. That's what he said.
That's not what he
said. That wasn't a direct.
Are you his interpreter or are you his vice president?
I believe as a Christian, I can tell my kids why it's important to have borders. I get that. There are laws, there are resources. I get all that things. It's much harder to explain when I see someone dragged out of a house or wrongly taken to a thing that isn't a violent criminal. It's a little more nuanced as a parent to try to say when someone's referred to as vermin or scum, when I teach them in school about people that have done that before, but this is different. It's very hard as a parent and a Christian to say both things.
I would urge you as a Christian and as a father to visit those detention centers where the children are being held.
So you guys have thrown a lot at me, and I see we got 30 seconds left here, but let me say, number one.
You're the vice president, you can go long.
Sounds like that went well. What did you guys think? Anyone watch more of it?
I watched a bunch of it. They did a great job. And what they did that I think we heard there was the questions weren't like from a shitty liberal perspective. It was like, as a Christian, as a human being, how can you as a parent like see what's happening at the Dilley Detention Center and be okay with that? And I think J.D. Vance, credit to him, I guess, for going there, right? He's clearly trying to make an argument that he's the kind of candidate that can build bridges and reach new voters by going on The View, right? Like that's like a thing you tell people you did. He answered the questions, but I don't think he did a good job. And he also just cannot help but sound like a whiny little bitch who thinks he is the victim of everything.
Yeah, he also says Democrats are terrible at one point. It's just not possible to be, it's not possible to fairly answer questions, defend Donald Trump and build and sort of be tilting at any kind of broader sort of a nonpartisan coalition. Like it's just that those things, there's no talent on earth that could both defend Donald Trump and pretend to be some kind of broader, more appealing figure. It's just not, can't be done. And so I don't think he could do it, but I think there are people that are far more talented than J.D. Vance that would make it look a little bit easier.
He's just so bad. He's terrible. Like in those answers, like he thinks he's being smart,
by basically just gaslighting about what it is Trump actually said. And he just doesn't, like, there's a way, like, defending Donald Trump is an impossible task. It just, you cannot do that and remain any sort of dignity or seriousness as a human being. You just can't. But there's ways to do it with more charm.
He sounds so condescending. Humor.
Yeah, he just has no charisma.
Yeah.
And Swarm. I mean, you know, and I think he goes on The View, and I think in his mind, maybe he wants to show that he can go to this other place. I also think he wants to show that he can go own the libs. Remember when he went on Blue Sky for like a hot minute to take people on?
Well, you just referenced Lovett, that he calls Democrats terrible people. So he did that.
Was that Megyn Kelly?
Yeah, that was on later. It was Gutfeld at night.
You're right.
Because I saw that clip. And I realized that, his whole play was, I'll go on The View and then they'll beat me up and then I'll go to the right wing outlets and I'll be like, oh, I survived The View and they were such assholes and blah, 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 blah. But he does this thing, and they didn't
even beat him up, though. They were like very substantive.
And the way he said that, too, it was such a, he's like, and the thing about Democrats that I don't like, it's not the policies necessarily, it's that they're terrible people.
Right.
And they're not grateful to the country. He did the grateful thing.
Well, the thing that's even worse than that is he couldn't stop himself. He started by saying, like, the thing that bothers me about Democrats is it's not their policies, it's not this, it's that they're not, I think, the grateful thing, I think, in this context, what he was trying to awkwardly do was that, like, to try to suggest we run down America. But he knew he was on Fox. We couldn't just say that. So he had to say, it also bothers me that some of them are terrible people. Like, that's, he looks like an aside.
It wasn't even some. Yeah. It was terrible people. Yeah. And I was like, that is a wild thing. Does he think that he can just, I mean, I know he's going to run in a primary here, but does he realize that kind of undermines the whole softening your image effort?
I just don't think he's crazy. He has no deafness.
I realize he was on the book tour. It is crazy that Marco Rubio has just gone into witness protection. He's the national security advisor and the secretary of state. Has he done a single interview about the Saran deal?
There's a picture of him over Trump when Trump's signing the treaty in Versailles. Yeah. And he looks like...
Did you guys watch him behind Trump in the press conference?
Yes.
Shifting back and forth, like dead-eyed. He looked like he'd taken like 6,000 Pro-V and hadn't slept in a month. Like, just looked miserable.
Well, before we go, I do think we should talk about briefly the reflecting pool.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the thing in the news now, because the reflecting pool. So let me get this straight. Please correct me if I've got the facts wrong.
This is important to me because I've been on vacation for 2 weeks. So in my trying to avoid learning something, this is the thing that I know very little about.
That's
so
fun.
I'm excited to learn in a very loving fashion.
Explain it to Dan.
Here's what I think. Obviously, Trump decided to paint the reflecting pool.
Yes.
He did the American flag blue. Then they refilled.
What was it? How do you describe the paint?
It was like thick, rubbery.
Rubbery.
Throbbing. Mm-hmm. So they painted it. They filled it up again. And then it quickly turned green because of algae.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there was a green reflecting pool after spending however much he spent to make it blue. And then they just quickly had parks people or interior people or whatever run over there and start dumping
hydrogen peroxide.
Dumping it into the reflecting pool as if like this reflecting pool is quite large, as Donald Trump showed us on his chart. And just like doing a couple buckets was not really going to do anything. And then they had like algae scoopers in there.
Getting the algae off the bottom.
And then the Department of Interior this morning decided to post a series of tweets that was like, it's back. And they have a picture of the water is blue again, which I think is just a fake picture.
Nice.
And they said, and the algae is gone from the algae is now just at the bottom of the reflecting pool, just like the Iranian Navy.
Yeah.
The
Department of Interior, which in a previous era might have posted a picture of, say, Zion National Park. Boy, check out Zion National Park. We think everybody's going to love it. They're like, you fucking cuck bitches. This thing is blue now. It's crazy. They drained the pool. They painted it a darker color, but a bluer color, whatever. Okay. They claimed because, Obama and Biden, they didn't have the stuff to fix the replay. They couldn't get it done. But like, as we all complained about for years, it was a big thing we really cared about. So they're going to do it. They're going to fix it. And then the algae comes back. Why? Well, maybe because Donald Trump isn't magic. And because it is an 8-acre short fucking swamp painted black in the middle of a swamp and there's algae. And so
maybe the paint color American flag blue doesn't have magical properties that get rid of algae.
I regret to say that I read a long Washington Post article about this, because there's all this like drainage and filtration infrastructure that they didn't actually choose to fix. And that's the core problem.
Well, so
just painted it.
So it's the other part of this too is
a perfect metaphor for the entire fucking administration. Well,
so I'm telling you to drain the swamp, if you will.
Yeah. But so of course the algae comes back. Now the Interior Department then puts out a statement saying, actually, this is residual algae. And it's like, it's not we don't believe in spontaneous creation of life anymore. We're not Lamarckians or whatever it was. Who are the fucking people? Oh, that's evolving quickly. Who's the ones that thought the maggots became the that maggots spontaneously arise? Yes. Thank you, Reed.
How do you know this, Reed?
Because we didn't have sports. Nobody invited us to Flip Cup, so we learned about these things. But it's always residual algae. That's where the algae fucking comes from. Now they did. Now hydrogen peroxide can shock a pool. However, the percent
a pool,
the kind they were using, the 12%, that's for a hot tub. This is a 7 million gallon tank. You would need. At least 5,000 to 7,000 gallons of this stuff. And that's just to get it clean for a week. And then they're like, well, the new nano rubber tubes are going to work. And it's like, there is runoff because this is a park in the middle of a city that there's like from the Potomac and all the rest. So the algae is just going to keep coming back. And it is a great metaphor Donald Trump thinking, for people thinking the only problem has been that our leaders were stupid or didn't care or didn't break enough rules.
Donald Trump does something cheap and easy that he thinks is a magic solution. It's not. And then he pretends it is anyway.
And newsflash, Donald Trump Jr. now owns a hydrogen peroxide company.
Did you guys see like the Newsmax guy who was down at the reflecting pool doing interviews suggesting that the Democrats had sabotaged it?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Sabotage is everywhere. Everyone thinks we've been pouring phosphates. We've been fertilizing the fuck. Yeah. Yes.
And then Jesse Waters sent his like baby dork goon down there to be like, well, at least our president cared enough to fix it and try. Like, what are we doing here?
Also, PS, care about this? The Washington Post did report, by the way, that the ballroom, that they found an invoice to a contractor that for like $600 million and that half of it was going to be taxpayer money. Yeah. And so they've been lying the whole time. And then Notice reported, I believe, that they found out that OMB has been moving money from the Secret Service budget into doing it because they couldn't get it passed through Congress. So it is, look, we are paying for the ballroom after all.
Well, famously, Secret Service has had a great run recently, so they need more resources.
They had some loose change. Yeah. So that's happened. Anyway, we started
use that money to buy a couple pairs of binoculars, boys. Yeah.
Well, we started very inspiring. And we ended up with algae in the pool. Yeah. So it's a tale for our times. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This has been fun, guys. Everyone have a great weekend. That's our show for today. Alex Wagner will be back in the feed on Sunday with a conversation with historian and Substack titan, Heather Cox Richardson.
And thanks to the Obama Library for letting us in here.
Yeah, absolutely. Seriously.
That's great. Cool. Now let's go find our book somewhere.
Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Austin Fisher, Saul Rubin, McKenna Roberts, and Farrah Safari, with Reed Cherlin, Elijah Cohn, and Adrian Hill. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Ben Hethcote, Jordan Cantor, Charlotte Landis, Kirill Pelaviv, David Tolles, Mia Kelman, Ryan Young, and Naomi Single. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Hey, so listen, whether you're in the States, across the pond, or somewhere on the other side of the world, we love that you tune into Crooked for US News. But did you know we also have a UK news show? Yes, that's right. It's called Pod Save the UK.
Pod Save the UK is a no bullshit, unabashedly progressive conversation about politics focused on the issues that matter most to the people of Britain. With all the changes in our government, including the fun revolving door of prime ministers we have here, there's always lots to talk about.
And there's lots of fabulous guests to talk to, journalists, politicians, experts, comedians, and activists.
Yeah, we've had great comedians on as well, like Rosie Jones, Stuart Lee, Aisling B. We've also had Tommy Vietor on, who may be our boss.
We still don't know.
We're not quite clear on who our boss is. I thought it might be Tommy Vietor. I thought it might be Jon Favreau. I don't know if it's John Lovett. It's hard to say. It's not clear to us who our bosses are.
Some of our listeners call us irreverent but not stupid.
I object to that. I'm deeply
stupid.
It doesn't
sound too bad. So look, come check us out. Come join us. Pod Save the UK every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.